Thank you very much, Glenn. And although it's a not offshore wind, I think a lot of those lessons are transferable to the offshore wind industry in dealing with Maine communities. So we heard, I think, from all our speakers that there are necessarily impacts when you're planning and when you're deploying projects like this. There will be impacts with stakeholders, with the planning process, with developers. But the only way to make your voice heard is to be at the table early and often. And I think that's a common theme that ran through all the presentations. So with that, we had four speakers, so we're going to have a little less time for Q&A, but we have about 15 minutes. So yes, sir, Beth.
Kim expressed a concern that she had in her active committee as thoroughly as she'd like to have. I assume you had a similar challenge. You identify what the community responsibility that you had and the challenges you had for bringing that community along?
Sure. In Rhode Island, we're very fortunate to have an organization called the Commercial Fisheries Center of Rhode Island. And within that organization are the heads of 9 different commercial fishing groups. And we meet regularly on different topics, fisheries management practices, research projects, and so on and so forth. So we use that venue as a tool to get us all together and discuss different options as we went through the marine spatial planning process. I think that's an important luxury that we had. I don't know if there's something like that up here in Maine, but if there isn't, you need to come up with a way to get all the different user groups from the fishing community to get together and talk about their different needs.
There's an organization, a community-based organization in New Jersey, I believe, that in order to accommodate the fisheries, has offered equity opportunities for the fishermen to actually become owners of the wind project and make a revenue stream from that because they have to give up some of their fishing options. Has that ever been considered, and are you aware of that, and is that an interesting model?
I do know a little bit about that. That was one of the companies, I think, that the state of Rhode Island considered as a developer. They put a proposal in. They weren't chosen, so I didn't really follow it too much after that. I became more concerned with the deepwater wind and learning about them. It's a pretty neat idea. I just don't have a whole lot more information on that.
Don't
Rick, I
was
just a little follow-up. Did you have any difficulty getting all the fishermen involved, or? And if you did, how did you deal with people who just didn't want to participate? Or didn't you have that issue at all with all the fishermen? Yeah. I mean, I know the Rhode Island fishing
sure.
A little bit. And I'm just curious, did they all willingly participate, or did they have to be dragged in the door a little bit?
No, well, we had the different representatives from each industry working cooperatively with each other, and it was up to those individuals to go back to their constituents and say, hey, here's what's up, this is new, this is what we're going to do. And I know on my behalf anyway, at the Rhode Island Party and Charter Boat Association, our monthly meetings, I gave an update every month and let folks know what's going on, and I got their input, which I would then bring back to the whole group. So that's how we worked it. There's always going to be folks that just are super, super skeptical of the process, and I find I just do my best to reassure them that we're at least saying our piece. And the input that we were getting back from the SANT people was positive. So we kept saying, oh, hang in there, this might work out okay, and we'll get our piece. And just by being present at the meetings, I think was helpful to let those folks
just
know.
Just a quick follow-up. Is that process all done now? Is that a completed project, the SANT?
It's gone through the state process, and it was accepted by the General Assembly. I believe that was how it went. So it's official in Rhode Island. Now it's in the federal government's hands to accept it as part of their...
May I ask a follow-up question?
Sure, but then... One more.
No, 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 just on the same thing, because this is very interesting with that whole process. You took it so far, and then you turn it over to the feds, and did the feds redo what you did? Or
No, they just review it, and I'm not exactly sure of that process, but they I guess they accept it as in line with the Coastal Zone Management Act and so on and so forth.
Okay, thank you.
My understanding, and maybe someone out there can speak more knowledgeably about this, but the research went beyond state waters, but the purview of the Rhode Island legislature in terms of being able to accept and then draw up a plan was limited to the 3-mile boundary. So there's information and data and knowledge that goes further out as a result of the SAMP process,
yep.
Whether it be fishing or any of those factors. But it's just that legally, Rhode Island can't reach out further beyond that 3-mile boundary.
Yeah. There is a process called federal consistency, and I'd be glad to talk to you on the side after.
At the back, yes, sir.
Yes, Ron Huber. I have two questions, but one, Rick, you said we went through a lot. I wondered if you have a number of hats you wear, New England Fishery Management Council, the ASMFC, and so on. Have any of those alphabet soups been involved in this, like the New England Fishery Management Council, in reviewing this plan?
Yeah, I believe they were all consulted through that Fisheries Technical Advisory Committee. If there were any questions, they didn't attend a lot of the meetings, but if there were questions that came up policy-wise or regulatory-wise, the SAMP team would approach them and be in contact with them.
Okay, because I understood that they were not participating in the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Plan, which I guess is a whole different ball of wax.
Yeah, that is a little different.
Yes, sir.
Toby Williamson with Barton & Gingold. This is a question for you, Kim. We plan and run stakeholder campaigns similar to offer for developers. You mentioned you were a bit skeptical at the beginning about whether it was a real process or not. I'm just curious, was there a turning point for you where you realized that it was? And even if there wasn't, what sort of contributed to that point when you decided, okay, this is a real process?
And I'll say the skepticism had more to do with the state involvement than the developer involvement. And I'll also say that basically I'm an optimist, and I take people at face value, and I've had to adopt the protective cover of skepticism. So I actually fell in line pretty quickly because the first few meetings I saw a great range of everything from fishermen to, and they were fighting amongst themselves sometimes. And to, whether or not they should be on board or not on board, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like there was even some disagreements there, and I saw that the nonprofits, Audubon Society, TNCs, and Conservation Law Foundation were there, and when I saw the range, it wasn't just politicians and regulators, legislators and regulators putting on a pretend process, it felt pretty real right away. So I was converted fairly quickly. Again, I tend to start off positive and have to be driven away from that. I will say that the person who managed, and there were many, the SAMP plan had many. Rick was involved in a whole host of stuff besides the general stakeholders. You were involved in a lot of fisheries special technical groups. So the meetings I attended were just the broad generalists, but there were breakouts for cultural interests or economic interests and fishermen interests that I wasn't directly involved in. But the convener, the person who facilitated the stakeholders process that I was involved in, was fantastic. And he was well received and well respected in the state, so people showed up with a level of confidence that this person was on the up and up, and I think that helped a lot, in my opinion. Ken Payne, who facilitated it for us, sort of set the stage for, okay, this is real. So.
Go down front.
Richard Nelson. I was asking, Rick, did the state or somebody fund full economic studies of the various fisheries? As far as being the fisheries and as an industry and back through the communities and the state?
The short answer to that is no. Not complete.
Would it have been very helpful? Not to be on a level of passion.
It's expensive, though, and that was one thing.
Knowledge.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was something that we had to get over pretty quick because we were demanding full research throughout the entire SAMP area, and we wanted to know all the answers, and it just cost too much money. And that was something that we had to understand. There is existing data that they've had through URI and some of the local universities that they did use, and then we were given the opportunity to examine that data and then question it and offer specific areas that they could improve on their data. And it's still by no means complete, but I feel it's better than it was when they started.
Let's go over here and then back to Suzanne.
Carly Dunter, Penobscot Studies Resource Center. Rick, I'm wondering if you had noticed through this process, if you had noticed the various fishing organizations becoming stronger in their internal organization. Did you see like any real like support being built for their representation or anything like that?
I do think one area that we became stronger is within our relationship with the different political figures in the state. By meeting them and talking about the different challenges that we faced, they just got to know us better and more about what we do. So that in itself was helpful. I think we're a pretty strong group of guys to begin with as far as dealing with the fisheries managers and all the different challenges that we've had to face in the past, so we had that foundation already. But politically, definitely it helped.
Thanks. My question is for John. Cuttyhunk is similar to Block Island, Monhegan, and Matinicus in that it's totally reliant on very expensive diesel power. And I'm wondering if during the conversations about community benefit and sort of what that would mean, and with one of the areas being sited pretty closely to Cuttyhunk, if the potential for cable like on Block Island or some sort of mitigation to help lower the high cost of energy on that community has been brought up.
Yes, absolutely. And we, on purpose, left the definition of community benefit fairly broad. So it could include electrons, it could include lower rates, it could include infrastructure like a cable, it could include money for conservation programs. It's what we built into it was that it would be up to the affected community to determine what was a priority to it. And then we as the state would carry that torch going forward. And yes, folks in Cuttyhunk are very interested in that. I think the last time I was out there, which was a couple of months ago, they're paying about 60 odd cents a kilowatt hour.
Yes.
I just had a Manila Balkan Island Institute. I just had a question. Rick, you had mentioned that kind of the dynamic nature of fisheries, and I was just curious if you or maybe also John could speak to how you navigated that issue when you were trying to kind of spatially represent fisheries and that changing nature of the areas that supported those fisheries.
Well, I guess basically trying to
repeat the question.
Okay, I'm going to try to capture that. Well, Rick, do you want to kind of restate the question and then?
As I understood it, she was asking how we compensated for the dynamics of the different fishing species stocks and fisheries itself. How do you capture that and maybe predict where the next change would be? And that's difficult to do, honestly, but I feel like comparing the old data that the state had to the new data and providing the state, or the SAMP team anyway, with accurate data was key to us being able to track trends and maybe try to do some predicting, but that's what dynamics are. You know, it's hard to really pinpoint that.
All right, I think we have time for two more questions, one and then two.
Kim, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned the funding you received from the developer to do the study on the island. From what I understand, the SAMP was funded in large part by the developer. Could you talk a little bit about how that may have influenced the process, at least the public perception of it, and any thoughts you might have on funding for MSP in general?
Yeah, I'll give that a try. I know that some of the funds definitely came or are slated to come from the developer to pay for the resource, and that was one of the reasons for some of the studies and for the sampling. It was a very expensive process, and you know, Rick alluded, and still there wasn't enough money to do the real kind of in-depth biology and ecological studies that you'd want to do. So that in itself, sort of coming out early on, set the, well, is this real? Is the developer paying for the information? And how good can that be? But again, there's in the same way that Block Island was able to get the developer to help us with our costs for engineering and economic analysis and legal stuff, It was at arm's length. They don't get that money back. They don't get to decide who's going to do the study or who's going to do provide the information. So I feel very confident that that's a legitimate process, and I sometimes have equated it to a lot of times you go to a zoning or a planning board and you come in with a plan, a big development plan. A lot of towns will require that you that the developer pay for the town to review that, because a town board can't afford the cost to do the, you know, the second review to make sure that it's an honest proposal. So I think that the concept is not in itself flawed, if that's your question, and I think it's been beneficial both for the state. We wouldn't know what we know about those waters and the ecology if it wasn't for those monies. And those monies, you know, this economic environment, it's pretty tough. So let's get it from the entity that has the most to gain. So, and if I didn't quite understand your question, let me know.
No, I think that got it. So, final question, and then we're going to head on to the next session.
Question for John Weber. I think the largest wind farm proposal in the east, northeastern coast is Gateway in Massachusetts. After 5 years of trying, I don't have any idea where it stands now. And I was interested in whether your map might have shown a dot that showed where it was located with respect to approved or not approved areas. Where do they stand now, and does it stand inside or outside of approved area?
So I will do your last question first, because you're absolutely right. I should have shown on a map where the heck that is. They are located in Nantucket Sound. The wind facility itself is actually in federal waters. It's a place called the Donut Hole. So it is between Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. If you think about that, it's a triangle. They're sort of in the middle of that. A place called Horseshoe Shoals. And you're right, I should indicate that on the map. Where they stand in the process, they have received all of their state and federal permits. However, there is a federal lawsuit which has been brought, which has not been decided yet. And I'm not exactly certain the schedule for when it is going to be heard. And there is also an appeal in Massachusetts on the rates that were approved by the Attorney General. You heard a talk this morning about their rate being approximately 18 cents. That was appealed, and that also goes through a legal process in the appeal. So the bottom line is that they have two legal processes left to go through, and then they can go from there, depending on how those turn out. If you talk to the latest estimate of when they might get started, that I've heard is about a year to 18 months away.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Wonderful panel. Join me in thanking Dave and his panel. A couple of things before you go on break. Jennifer Atkinson's going to come up and.